On Sunday, many mothers will be celebrated and showered with affection. But there is a whole classification of mothers that has gotten very little respect until today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here today to give some overdue recognition to the mothers of the insect world. It's true that they do tend to be absentee mothers, but that doesn't mean that they don't work hard to ensure the survival of their offspring. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Things are growing, flowers are blooming, and horticulturist Richard Giron will be here in a few minutes to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start with the insect world and a Mother's Day tribute. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Good morning, Donald.
Good morning, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And insect moms don't get a whole lot of credit, but you're here to tell us that they are actually among the world's most successful mothers.
Well, if you think of success as number of offspring per female, the insects are doing very, very well, with some insect mothers being able to produce hundreds or thousands of offspring. Now, not all of them make it, but in terms of their reproductive potential, they are very good at it. And your description of insect mothers as absentee seems to fit what most people think about when you talk about female insects lay eggs. And then the story sort of stops and the female is out of the picture. But getting to that point of laying eggs, there are incredible details that are taken care of. And even after the eggs are laid, some insects continue to exhibit what we would call maternal care.
Well, let's pick an insect and talk about how she would prepare for laying eggs with an eye on the survival of those offspring.
Well, let's start with something down and dirty. Let's talk about dung beetles. We don't get to see a lot of those in Iowa, down in the southern part of the state. They are these large scarab beetles that find a fresh cow pie or a fresh piece of dung, and they rip off a chunk of it, and they roll it carefully into a ball and take it over and bury it and prepare a food reserve for their offspring. Now, even the fact of finding fresh dung the way they do is a survival mechanism because it will still be fresh. They will get it before the competitors get it, and it will still be moist and have enough moisture to support their offspring. Burying it preserves the freshness and the moisture. Then they put an egg with the dung ball, and that's the food for the offspring. So all of that work by dung beetles is preparing for the survival of the next generation.
The tomato hornworm caterpillars also work very hard to prepare, right?
Well, I don't know if it's hard work for them, but even
it would be hard for me.
Well, yes, because tomato hornworms are evolved to only eat tomato and tobacco and a few other related plants. So the question comes up every time you see a tomato hornworm on tomato, or you see a cabbage worm on cabbage, or you see a corn borer on corn. How did those caterpillars get to the exact right food that they need to survive? And the answer is, mom put them there. The only way the tomato hornworm caterpillar can survive is if the female hornworm, the moth, has the capability of looking over the entire landscape, picking out tomato plants, and putting her eggs there. Monarch butterflies only survive on milkweeds. How do the caterpillars end up on the milkweeds? Mom put the egg there. So this ability to sort out from all of the vegetation of your yard and garden, all the vegetation of the county, to find just the right plant is a pretty good trick when you think about it's being done by an insect flying around at night.
It's amazing. And we've talked about the cicada killer wasps. That's another one where they do a lot to prepare for their offspring having plenty to eat.
incredible amount of work for a wasp with nothing but teeth and front legs to dig a burrow the diameter of a quarter dollar anywhere from 18 to 24 inches deep into the ground, then to be able to search the landscape and find one of those annual cicadas that's buzzing in the trees in the second half of the summer, paralyze it with a specialized venom that paralyzes but does not kill, and then to lug the cicada that's bigger than her back and stuff it down in the hole in the ground and lay an egg and go away. Now, in that case, all the maternal care, all the preparation was done before the egg was laid. As far as we know, she's not coming back and taking care of her offspring, but she did an incredible amount of work to get ready to lay that egg so her offspring would survive.
So rolling a ball of dung or paralyzing a cicada, there are a lot of insects who do a lot of work to lay aside food for their offspring.
Exactly. And things like mud dauber wasps, the ones that build the tube on the side of your porch in a secluded area, those wasps gather wet soil, they form it into a tube, and then in that tube, they stuff it full of paralyzed spiders, and then they lay their eggs. And those paralyzed spiders become the smorgasbord on which her offspring will feed. But she built that whole structure just as protection and as a shelter to hold the food that her offspring would need to grow to maturity.
The sympathy factor is not rising with all of the paralyzed food, I don't think. But that's really remarkable. I mean, they must do that because if they just killed something, then it would degrade and it wouldn't be there for their offspring to eat, right?
It's kind of a neat way to preserve your food, if you think about it, that you paralyze it. It's not dead. It's not decaying. It's not rotting and decomposing. But it's also no longer able to run away from you. Spiders do that, too. When a female spider catches something on her web, she'll run over. She'll inject some venom to paralyze it. She'll wrap it up with silk to make sure it doesn't get away and save that food for a moment, for a while. So, yes, it is kind of interesting the way we preserve food and the way insects will make sure they have a food source for later on.
So there are some insects that actually do care for their offspring, right?
Exactly. In more ways than just sort of making things ahead of time. The first insect that I did a research project on is the two-mark treehopper. I was an undergraduate and a biology major, and we worked on this treehopper as a special project where the female covers the eggs with foam and then stands around and makes sure nobody comes and gets them. So she has this double mechanism of protecting her eggs. Other treehoppers do that as well, that they stay with the offspring, and even after they have hatched, they have protected the eggs, they have watched over them, they will herd their offspring, this clutch of nymphs, they will herd them together and make them stay in a group and protect them from predators and will actually flap their wings and jump on predators that approach her brood. So there are those kinds of active mechanisms for doing that. Others will protect the eggs. One of my favorites is the European earwig, sort of a despised critter that lives in your garden and nibbles on your petunia flowers occasionally. She cleans and turns the eggs to make sure there is no fungus growing on this clutch of eggs that she has laid in a depression in the soil under a rock. She stays with those eggs. She turns them. She grooms them until they start to hatch. The nymphs, or the offspring, eat their eggshells, and then she continues to provide food until they're ready to leave that depression and move out on their own.
That's amazing. And there are insects that actually carry their eggs with them?
There are some. One that we see frequently in Iowa, this now takes parental cooperation, the female giant water bug. This is a 2-inch long insect that lives in our rivers and streams. When the female is ready to lay her eggs, she pastes them, glues them in place on the back of the male. And then as the male swims around, the eggs are refreshed with oxygen and water flowing over his back. But also, as he moves, he's protecting her eggs from predators. So he's carrying her eggs around with her. One of the disgusting examples of maternal care of the eggs, although there's not much after that, but the female German cockroach that lives under the sink in the college apartment that you had, she carries her eggs with her. until they are ready to hatch, and that's a protective mechanism. So she is carrying those eggs around as well. So carrying them, protecting them, grooming them, these are all things that we see mothers doing in the insect world.
And this time of year, of course, this is when a lot of insects are emerging. Do we see egg laying happening often in the spring, or is that something that happens more often in other times of the year?
It's also highly variable. When you're looking at a million species of insects in the world and 20,000 species in Iowa, we can find an example of everything. The few mosquitoes who survived last year's drought laid their eggs last fall, and those eggs survived the winter. The praying mantis, the large green insect, 4 inches long, laid her eggs last winter, and the eggs had to survive the winter and will hatch now at the end of May. But other things like lady beetles, the adults spent the winter, or the box elder bug that was on your windowsill, that spent the winter in the adult stage and will lay eggs in the spring. Those are probably the two major ways. Of course, everyone's waiting for the monarch butterflies to return from Mexico. They will lay their eggs toward the beginning of summer. So spring, summer, fall, we can find insects actively laying eggs at any time.
One of the things that I find most fascinating about insect mothers is that so often their offspring physically have nothing in common with their mothers.
Well, especially in insects that have a complete life cycle, the butterflies, the beetles, the flies. If you looked at a maggot, it would be almost science fiction to believe that that maggot is going to pull into some hardened case, digest its own body, and reappear as an adult fly with wings. You look at the ugly caterpillar that turns into the beautiful butterfly, it almost seems like that would be science fiction for that transformation to take place. But that's a way of dividing the resources. Maggots and flies don't eat the same food, so one individual insect has utilized two different parts of the ecosystem during its lifetime. Other insects, the offspring do look like the female or like their adult, and that would be things like cockroaches and crickets and grasshoppers and katydids and praying mantids. The offspring do resemble the adults and pretty much live in the same places and eat the same food.
Only smaller and cuter, just like people, right?
Just like people. And, of course, the immature insects never have wings. Just like we don't give driver's licenses to small children, small insects, immature insects don't get their wings. They can't fly until they reach the adult stage.
And take a written test, possibly a driving test.
Possibly a driver's test. We're not real sure about that. But, gee, you think of birds and mammals getting all the attention in how mothers take care of their offspring. But there it is in the insect world as well.
Well, we've sent a lot of flowers their way this year. So
that's good.
Just a little thank you, says spring. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll get back to answering your questions. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be joining us momentarily. And it's time for your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, post on our Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here as well. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here, and I think we finally have it. We really have spring, and it's going to end on Tuesday, and we're going to go straight to summer.
Could be. They say 80, so.
That's what my forecast is telling me today. But my cherry trees are in bloom. My apple trees are just popping right now, and I'm a happy woman, so.
It should be nice next week, yes.
All right, let's get to the phones at 866-780-9100. Terry is on the line from Anita. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a question about some pollinating insects that were on my apricot trees. There were quite a few varieties of different bees, including honeybees, mm-hmm. but there was one about one quarter of the size of a honeybee, and there were quite numerous, and they seemed to not be interested in gathering either pollen or nectar, but only to harass the other bees. They would just dive at them and dislodge them. And I just wondered if there's a name given to those, the smaller than a sweat bee, I guess you'd call it, somewhere in there. But they just seemed to hover, and then when they saw somebody busy, why, they would dive bomb it.
Yeah. Well, that's an exact name is not coming to me, but when we start talking about pollinators, there are dozens of these smaller solitary bees that we have pretty much ignored for most of our time studying pollination because we thought the European honeybee was all we would ever need, but there are others out there. I don't have a name for this one. I wish it had some clever name. I wish there was something already invented like harassment bee or something. But I don't know. The little green bees sometimes just seem to do that, but the small green bees are some of those solitary pollinators. I don't have a name for that, but I kind of wish you had a video of it because if we put it on YouTube, I think it would go viral.
Maybe yeah. Next time, Terry.
Yeah, I don't have a name for it, Terry, but it's an interesting one. And of course, when I go back to the department and talk to others, they'll say, well, of course, it's such and such, and I'll have learned something today, too.
Okay, well, thank you
very much. Thanks a lot for your call, Terry. Next up, let's go to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm turning up the volume. I was wondering how the spiders, once they wrap their prey in silk, are able to cut through that silk, considering the fact that that silk might be as strong as the silk from silkworms.
It is quite tough. It is quite durable. Cut through might be not quite the right word. I think if we use the word puncture, it will be a little easier to picture what's happening there. And I don't know that this is true for all spiders, but the ones that we're familiar with use something called external digestion, that prey that was wrapped up in silk was injected with enzymes that are dissolving some of the innards of what is about to be a slurpy meal. And all the spider really has to do is puncture the silk, puncture the exoskeleton of the insect inside the silk, and then it can suck out the dissolved guts and everything else that's inside the insect.
Spiders drink their prey.
So largely they drink it. Now, eventually they do masticate. They do chew up some of their prey. We'll see that in some of the larger spiders as well. But it's not like they have to completely unwrap that. They could get by with just puncturing it with their chelicerae, their fangs, and extracting the good out of the host, out of their food prey that way.
All right, Craig, probably hungry now.
So close to lunch.
Right. Kathy, thanks a lot for your call, Craig. Kathy's on the line next from New Hampton. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was in North Carolina for quite some time, and I fell in love with holly. And I now live in Northeast Iowa, and I was wondering if there is any type of species or variety that would grow in that area.
Well, we can. We can't grow the common American holly. It's not reliably hardy. There's a group called the Meserve hybrid hollies, and things like China Boy, China Girl, Blue Prince, Blue Princess, and these are quite hardy, and we can grow these. These are more of a shrub, where they might get to be maybe 4 or 5, 6 feet tall, kind of a spreading type shrub. And you do need at least one male. You can plant several females so you have the attractive fruit. As far as a site, they would typically do best where they have, let's say, several hours of sun, preferably morning sun, afternoon shade, where it has a little bit of protection in the wintertime. But we can grow those quite well. So I'd look for like China Boy, China Girl, Blue Prince, Blue Princess, those type.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Kathy, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post your question on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. And let's do an email question here. This is from Eric in Davenport. We have a large maple, I believe it's a Norway maple, in our front yard that has yet to leaf or show strong signs of budding. Last year, this tree had very few leaves on its main outer branches. The largest concentration of leaves seemed to be growing directly from the trunk. I assumed that was due to the drought conditions, since there were several other maples in the city that looked like this. Before last year, the tree's canopy was dense and deep green. So far this year, the only signs of reasonable growth are several small new branches up and down the length of the main trunk. He doesn't remember this maple as being particularly slow to leaf in past years.
Those are not good signs, what you describe basically. When a tree is having problems, typically there are symptoms. There are kind of warning signs. And one is that they drop their leaves early in the fall. Another is that they may leaf out late in the spring. When they do leaf out, they leaf out more sparsely than normal. You may see dead branches in the tree. So basically we're seeing signs that the tree is in very poor health. And I guess what they really should do is I would wait another couple weeks. If the tree hasn't leafed out by the end of May, or much of it hasn't, then I would assume much of that tree basically is dead. And unfortunately, at that point, cut it down. So, but I would give it a couple more weeks and see what it does. But it sounds like the tree is declining, and my guess is that decline is irreversible.
Okay.
So not a good thing.
And he mentioned seeing other trees that looked like this last summer. Do you think that this is a drought victim?
That may have played a part. Maybe it was the last straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, and the tree just simply could not deal with it. It's amazing how many trees did survive the drought pretty well. But we have seen some trees, especially some of the evergreens, that simply could not cope with the extreme heat and the drought.
Right. And as we mentioned, was it last week? I think a lot of brown arborvitae
all over
the place.
We've taken down some of our Norway maples on campus, haven't we, because they weren't doing well?
Well, I'm not sure that was the reason for it. They're not the best shade tree, and I think what they've done is maybe replace those with better trees.
Mm-hmm.
So. All right, let's get back to the phones, and this is Rita on the line from Kelowna, Illinois. Hi, Rita.
Good morning.
Hi.
I would like the gentleman to describe the egg sac of the praying mantis.
It's usually tan in color, as much as an inch in diameter. It will be attached to the twigs of a shrub, usually 2 to 3 feet off the ground, up in the air, and it will be like a piece of dried insulation foam. It will be foamy. It will look like dehydrated bubbles that have sort of stuck together. It will wrap around the twig, but it will come loose from the twig when you jerk on it. It's just glued in place. It's not as firmly attached as, say, a gall would be. So they're fairly distinctive. I would say light tan is the color, and they're very lightweight. There's almost no mass to them at all as you find them. We only expect to find these in southern Iowa. Does that match where you would be in Illinois?
No, they're quite prevalent. We live on 7 acres, and they're quite prevalent. I do nature camps, and that's one of the things the kids participate in is to look for the teacup.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, with children, they retrieve a lot of different things. But I would like to know, I did hear you earlier say that they come out the end of May. And about how many are in
For the Chinese mantid, and that's the big 4-inch long green-bodied mantid that we see in the southern half of Iowa, the Chinese mantid lays her eggs in the fall, and they hatch the following spring, usually toward the end of spring if they're left outside. Now, if you make a mistake and bring it indoors and leave it in your classroom, they will hatch in February. They'll get warm enough that they'll hatch in February. And the average my guess is anywhere from about 150 to 200 eggs per egg case. Now, there's an interesting behavior here that the nymphs, the little tiny quarter-inch long praying mantids, have a one-day head start before they eat. If they are still together, confined in a cup or in a jar on the second day, they will begin to eat each other, and you'll end up with about two. But for a day, they have a chance to scatter and get away from their brothers and sisters. Now, if you're going to try and raise them, that means you have to raise them one per cup and find something for them to eat, some fresh meat for them to eat. And that's a bit of a problem. But the answer to your question is 150 to 200 eggs.
All right, Rita, thanks a lot for your call. And I know a number of people who bring them inside and let them hatch out in a jar and then release them back into the garden.
It's a great thing to see, and it's one of those events that, nothing's happening, you look away, you turn back and look at the praying mantis egg case on the windowsill in the jar, and it's covered with these little quarter-inch long nymphs that are all just sort of standing there staring off into space, and there's just more and more, and they start to kind of cascade down the side, clinging to each other. It's a spectacular thing to see when it happens. Unfortunately for me, it usually happens on the weekend when I'm at home and not in the office watching my windowsill.
Does that mean you come back to a lot of eaten praying mantises?
Yes, it does. I speak from experience when I talk about they will get hungry enough to start eating each other, but not right away. And I just find that fascinating that that's built into their evolution to wait a day before you start eating.
Interesting. And that's a critter that a lot of people want in their gardens, right?
Well, sure. Praying mantid is a predator. It's beneficial. It eats other insects, but it is an indiscriminate predator. It will sit on your flower, and normally we see this in the fall of the year. This isn't something that happens in the springtime that we're going to see soon. So we're talking about late next summer. These 4-inch-long praying mantids will be sitting on a flower, and they'll eat bumblebees. Wait a minute. We like bumblebees. They will eat butterflies. They will eat grasshoppers. They will eat some pests, but they're indiscriminate. They will eat whatever they can catch. And so it's not like they're going to pick off the aphids and do you a favor. They're going to eat what comes to them. And that even includes, unfortunately, an occasional hummingbird will get snatched from the air and eaten by a praying mantis. So being an indiscriminate predator doesn't make you quite as useful to us as we would like.
some of the more discriminating predators.
That's right.
All right, let's get back to the phones at 866-780-9100. Jason is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jason.
Hello. I had a question about ticks. I seem to be picking an unusually large number of ticks off the dog this spring, and I was wondering two things. Is this a bumper year, or have I just not noticed this before? And also, where is the dog picking all of these up? Are they living in the grass in the yard somewhere?
Ticks are an interesting situation. The tick population is an interesting situation because every year someone will call with your observation, Jason, that this is the worst it's ever been. And mm-hmm. The next caller will call and say, I haven't found any ticks. Where did they all go? It is so spotty how ticks develop and where they live that for somebody it's always the worst year ever, and for somebody else it's their best year ever. It's just that variable from place to place. Ticks live in areas that are overgrown with undergrowth, that is tall weeds, brambles, areas that protect the ground from drying out, and where there is abundance of little tiny small mammals that serve as their food source when you and the dog aren't there. So we're not talking about the middle of the lawn. They're not in the cut grass that dries out. They would desiccate there. There's not much for them to eat. But at the edge of the lawn, at the edge of the park, at the edge of the woodland are the areas where the ticks are going to be most abundant. And they just sit and wait for you to walk by, or you or your dog to walk by. They don't go running around looking for us. They sit still with their legs waving in the air, and when warmth and carbon dioxide approaches them, they latch on and then they climb up on us. So you're getting them at the edge of the woods is probably the best answer to your question.
All right, Jason, thanks for your call. We're having a medium tick year, Donald, in our household.
A medium tick year so far.
only two so far.
Yep, and I'm having a good tick year. I haven't found any yet.
But, congratulations.
My luck could change, too.
All right, let's try to squeeze in one more call before the break. Al is on the line in Indianola. Hi, Al.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was given a couple of azaleas, and I want to know if they'll grow in our area, and if so, where would be the best place to plant them as far as a site?
Okay, do you know the type or name?
Nope.
Okay. Were they meant for indoor use as far as a flowering plant that we buy at a florist or at a greenhouse?
I think they came from a florist.
Okay. If it's a florist, those types are forced in a greenhouse, and they are not hardy outside. They would not survive the winter. You can keep them as a house plant if you wish, but they are simply not hardy outside. If you wanted to, just put them in a sunny window. Make sure you keep the soil moist. You could bring them outside, but leave them in the pot and just keep on watering them outside if it doesn't rain. Bring them inside in the fall and see what they do. Most people simply discard them. We can grow certain azaleas, but definitely not the greenhouse type.
All right, Al, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back to answer more of your questions at 866-780-9100. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100 or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And let's do a couple emails here. This is from Lori in Des Moines. I've planted daisies, yarrow, black-eyed Susans, and coneflowers. Do these do best with mulch around the plants, or does the mulch interfere with the natural spread of the plants?
I would mulch basically to conserve moisture and also kind of control some of the weeds. So they will still kind of spread. Now, when you mulch around a perennial, you basically place the material between the plants, but don't actually cover where the plants actually are. So you mulch around the actual plants.
All right. Here's another email from Dick in West Des Moines. I'm looking for a bush that will grow 6 to 8 feet tall and be almost as wide. Burning bush comes to mind. Are there others I should consider?
If it's a burning bush, it needs to be a dwarf cultivar or variety, because they can get much bigger than that. I would look maybe at a arrowwood viburnum. They are native to Iowa. They commonly get to be 6 to 8 foot tall, has creamy white flowers in the spring, bluish berries in August. Another possibility would be the common bridal wreath spirea, which grows about 6 to 8 foot tall and is practically indestructible, and has the white flowers in the spring. Has that kind of an arching, fountain-like appearance.
All right. And this one's for you, Donald. Somebody wants to know, this is Roy, I guess, and Rolf, wants to know about the mothers of horsehair worms. He says, I understand they have quite the life cycle. I see them swimming in my pet's water tray some years.
And he is looking at the mother in that case. The full-grown horsehair worm develops inside the body of crickets and some other large insects. An interesting adaptation is that as this infested cricket is carrying this 6 to 14 inch long roundworm coiled up in its body, the cricket gets very thirsty, and it goes toward his pet watering dish, it goes to the horse trough, it goes to the stream or the lake, and as the cricket's dying, that 6 to 14 inch long roundworm escapes the body and swims away. That is the adult stage of the horsehair worm. They lay their eggs at the water's edge. The next generation of crickets or grasshoppers will eat the grass and eat the eggs and begin the life cycle over inside. So the horsehair worm that you see swimming in the horse water trough, hence the name horsehair worm, or swimming in your pet water dish, is the adult stage.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Amy is on the line next in Crawfordsville. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I live out in the country, and I took a part of my property and made it into a pasture. And I've got peonies growing there, the previous owner I planted. And last year, the goats ate them down to the ground, so I couldn't tell where they were. But this year, now that they're growing, I was wondering, can you replant them now? I mean, I know it's probably not the best time, but I want to get them out of harm's way.
It would be hard, but it's doable if you give them extremely good care. So what you would do is go out there with a spade and dig them up and try to dig them up with a nice ball of dirt around the root system and then immediately take them to where you want them and plant them. And I would do this in the evening, not midday, but evening, and then do this promptly, replant them, water them nicely, and then keep them well watered for at least several weeks. And if you do that, I think you'll be okay, but they're going to have to be watered fairly often. And I would definitely do it in the evening so they have at least that night to absorb some water.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Amy. Next up, Cecile in Iowa City. Hi, Cecile.
Hi. I have two questions. One is about the licorice, or I call the resurrection lily. I have some that have grown up in a place they need to be moved. If I were to move them now, would they bloom this August?
Probably not, because what they need to do, what the foliage is doing, is manufacturing food and then storing that food in the bulb.
Right.
And they have to store enough food in the bulb in order to bloom in August. So the best time to actually transplant those would be as soon as they're done blooming, like in late August or September. So you know where exactly they are because you see the flower stalk.
Okay, thank you. My other question is about under a maple tree, about 12 feet out from the trunk of the tree, I would like to put a limestone flagstone patio. Would that damage the tree because you have to dig down about 6 inches to get the proper foundation built up before you put the stones down?
Yes, it would, because tree roots are actually quite shallow. You'll find tree roots just below the soil surface. The vast majority of a tree's roots are actually in the top 12 to 18 inches of soil. So they're actually very, very shallow, and especially maples. Maples have very shallow roots. Oftentimes, you'll see actually surface roots below maples where they have come above the ground. So,
but even 12 feet out from it?
Oh, they go out a tremendous distance from the trunk.
Okay.
So, for example, if you have a tree and the distance from the trunk to the drip line or canopy edge is 20 feet, the roots may be out 40 feet from the trunk. So they're quite extensive. Shallow, but extensive.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Cecile. And next up, let's go to Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
My question is about warm season grasses in the northern states, especially zoysia grass. Should those be on a different fertilizer treatment schedule, I guess, than normal cool season grasses?
Absolutely right, because they don't green up until typically mid to late May in central Iowa. So you basically fertilize that probably in June or July or August, when it's actively growing and when it's actively green. So we fertilize our cool season grasses in the spring and fall, but that's a warm season grass, so basically fertilize that during June, July, or August.
Okay, so putting down fertilizer, say, in March on zoysia is going to be pretty moot. It's not really going to do anything then?
I think it might benefit the weeds more so than the zoysia grass, right, because the zoysia grass in March is basically dormant, and it really doesn't green up until later on, like in late May or so.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Kevin. And next up, let's go to Helen in Perry. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
It's a mystery. I'm wondering how spiders can weave a web across considerable distances without having any place to start from or drop from above.
It is a mystery, isn't it, that the spider web may be in the middle of two plants that are 10 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The one of the explanations that has been explained to me in the past is that the spider will sit and release a string of web, just a single line that floats in the wind. And if there's a little breeze, it will carry it. And if it lands on an adjacent twig or an adjacent plant, it will be just sticky enough to stay there, and that's the first line that goes from the plant. And then she can go back and forth across on that to reinforce it, and then to begin to build the web in the space in between. But sort of floating a piece of gossamer across the open space appears to be the explanation. Now, the only other thing they could do would be to attach one end, go down, crawl across the ground, dragging a line behind them, crawl up the other plant, and reel it in. And although both of those seem so highly unlikely, this floating a line across the open space seems like a much better explanation.
Well, and Donald, I saw a couple of years ago somebody wrote an article about spiders cooperatively building a gargantuan web. I think it was someplace in Texas. Is that a phenomenon that we see very often?
Not to the same extent as that Texas web. That was an incredible story that went viral, as they say. But no, we don't have that same communal activity here. We have on occasion, usually in the fall of the year, had mass spider egg hatches, and all the spiderlings will walk across the grass, and they're all spinning their little gossamer, dropping their little lines behind them, and you'll wake up in the morning and your entire lawn will be covered with webs. That was just all the spiders emerging at once and making webs, and most of them wandered off and died without reaching wherever it was they were going. But for spiders to get together and work as a group doesn't appear to happen up here for us.
Interesting. All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Helen. Let's get to Adrian in Osage. Hi, Adrian.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The lady just now spoke about a mystery. I have a mystery, too. How can thousands and thousands of box elder bugs live in my house very happily and also, I presume, we'll be having new babies themselves. And how can I stop that?
Yeah. If they are lucky, they will be able to get back to the trees and lay their eggs and reproduce, which is the only place they reproduce, is on the green foliage and the green twigs and seeds of various kinds of trees. The ones that got into your house are probably not the lucky ones, because they have wasted their energy by being active during the winter when they should have been hibernating, preserving their reserves, and having that last burst of energy to get back to the plants. Last year was just an exceptional year in many parts of the state, where we had the perfect combination of weather events to give us an outbreak of box elder bugs. That is, it was warm in May and it was dry in July. And they reproduced twice each summer, and they grew exponentially each time, and we ended up with an outbreak that we haven't seen for a while. So will it happen again? Depends on what the weather is, and the best we can do is seal up the cracks and gaps and try to keep them out. If it's terrible enough in September to October, you can spray the outside of the house. Once they're already in, your vacuum cleaner remains your most practical management tool.
All right, Adrienne, thanks for your call and good luck. And Marcia in Iowa City also has a box elder bug-related question. Did that cover it for you, Marcia, or do you have something else?
No, it's the outside. I understand that a box elder will get in the house now and then. Critters will do that. But I have so many that are clustered on my house. The tree is less than 20 feet from the house. The tree gets slathered with slashes of red from the box elder bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be standing at my sink in the kitchen doing dishes, and there'll be 20 box elder bugs crawling around on the window in front of me. And I go out the door, and there's dozens of bugs whirling around me.
What can I do? Well, enjoy them, name them, ignore them. You could go out and spray them with soapy water if you're a vengeful kind of person. But I think this outdoor exterior accumulations in the spring that many people have reported this year is unusual. It's an aberration that there were these large populations last year that made it through the winter. They got spring fever when the first warm temperatures came around and the days got longer. But then the trees didn't leaf out quite on schedule. And the box elder bugs that want to be on the green emerging foliage of the trees are hanging out waiting for the leaves to appear. So I think there was a timing issue this year that the box elder bugs maybe left hibernation a little sooner than they should have because the trees were behind schedule. I think this will take care of itself. Richard says the trees are going to leaf out and grow like crazy now. The box elder bugs will get back to the trees where they belong, and we won't be able to see them from the kitchen window anymore.
All right, so Marcia should take pictures, and she has a story to tell us. Wait.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a good story. They're moderately cute, but in large numbers, I understand the annoyance that they cause.
All right, Lauren is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, good morning. My daughter has for years taken in monarch caterpillars, and sure. We've raised them and let them go, and that happens over a several-week period.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, she decided to adopt a Cecropia moth caterpillar. So we adopted this caterpillar. We didn't know what he was. We looked him up. He or she is a Cecropia moth caterpillar, and after we had adopted and became attached, realized we had to overwinter his mm-hmm. cocoon. So we put his cocoon outside like the end of October or something, mid-October. And he's still in cocoon, and I'm wondering, when is his hatching point?
Not for a while yet. They are going to wait. They do seem to be kind of slow. I would say it's more like the end of May when we will see the Cecropias out. Sometimes in an early year, it's mid-May. If you think about it, the mother of the Cecropia moth female, is going to lay eggs where her offspring will survive, and they live on foliage of lots of different trees and shrubs. The foliage isn't there yet. If she emerged now and laid her eggs, there would be nothing for her offspring to eat. So she's timed to come just a little later when there will be a steady and abundant food supply for her offspring when she lays eggs on the trees.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much for your call. And we'll squeeze in one more question. This is from Carol. She says, I will move to Tama County soon, and I want to plant a cherry tree, but I'm worried about Japanese beetles. Are there any varieties which they do not attack? And what about other fruit trees?
No, they'll eat basically any cherry tree. They're not going to destroy the tree, but they may eat much of the foliage. And I would think by the time they show up, the fruit should be picked. So it shouldn't affect the crop at all. And as far as a cherry tree, the tart cherries or the pie cherries are best for Iowa. And some of the best varieties are like North Star and Meteor.
All right. And before we say goodbye today, Mother's Day is, we're not just going to celebrate the insects this year, but it is the traditional tomato planting time. Does everything look like it's on schedule, Richard?
It's going to be kind of cool this weekend, and maybe gardeners in northern Iowa may want to wait until maybe Monday.
Okay. And any other advice for what to do in the garden right now?
I think I would start planting a lot of things this weekend, at least buy things and maybe bring them home. Getting them hardened off for a few days.
And you say getting them hardened off. What do you do to make that happen?
I would put them possibly on the east side of a house where they get some morning sun, afternoon shade. They're kind of out of the wind because if it's really very windy or if you put them in full sun, that can sometimes damage the plants. So maybe harden them off for a few days.
All right. And that's because they've been in greenhouses coddled.
Right. They have been. Yes.
All right. Well, I hope that you have a lovely Mother's Day weekend, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis with us today. We'll be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed by the River Monks, but we're not able to play it right now, apparently. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, we'll talk about women's activism on the farm. This is Talk of Iowa.